you tend to get maybe a 5% increase in sales, a 10% increase in profits. That's not trivial for someone who's pretty close to the means of subsistence.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. How can we train the next generation of entrepreneurs? In developing economies, more than $1 billion a year is spent on this type of training, but does it work? Are we training the right people, giving them the right skills, and what opportunities might there be to do this better? David McKenzie of the World Bank and Chris Woodruff are the senior editors of the latest version of the Vox Dev Lit on training entrepreneurs that summarizes what we know, what we need to know, and what this all means for policy. And David is joining me now. David, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hi, glad to be here.
David, that statistic that I started with, more than $1 billion training entrepreneurs. Why is it so important to be doing this in low-income countries?
I think there's two reasons. So one is that there are just so many people trying to make a living running a business in developing countries. Mm-hmm. So if we're trying to help the livelihoods of people in developing countries, we need to be able to work with these entrepreneurs and see if we can help them do a bit better. And then the second thing is that the things that business training, that consulting, that these efforts are trying to do of how do you keep good business practices, how do you manage your firm well, are critical to the success of these firms. And so we have evidence across a whole range of countries that this seem to be good things. And so the question is, if these practices are so good, why aren't firms doing them and can we help them do these? And so that's the effort with all these training programs.
In this context, what do we mean by entrepreneurs?
Well, I think that's one of the challenges with trying to put together one of these reviews is that
yes,
that term does cover the whole spectrum from subsistence, micro enterprise owners who are just working by themselves, maybe selling small retail goods or making weaving or doing bicycle repair, up to the large number of small and medium enterprises that we have in these countries that got 10 or 20 workers. And then we also look at this much smaller group, but this group that's very interesting for innovation and exports, which is these high growth entrepreneurs trying to start up new innovative businesses. And of course, you need different types of programs for different types of firms. And so when we talk about training, it's not one size fits all.
Imagine for me a really positive outcome for policy that we could magically fix all those external frictions that we talk about a lot on Vox Dev Talks that hold firms back, bureaucracy and red tape, access to markets, access to finance, the rule of law, all of those external things. What other skills would those entrepreneurs, business owners need if they were to succeed?
You know, what we've seen from the last decade or so of research is that even in very high income countries, better management practices matter a lot for firms. That, you know, your ability to be able to organize your production process, acquire customers, monitor your finances, make budgets and plan, find the right workers and manage those workers well, all are critical for firm success. And so even if we're able to overcome all these other barriers, there's still going to be a big benefit from being able to manage your firm well. Now, in a low-income setting, all these constraints that you put forward may be other reasons that being able to be a good manager is particularly beneficial. Maybe you can figure out ways to overcome some of these constraints if you're a better entrepreneur as well. So there could be sort of an additional bang for your buck because of these constraints.
A lot of people think that being an entrepreneur is a talent. Can these skills be transferred? Can they be learned? Can they be taught?
An age-old debate is, are entrepreneurs born or are they made? And depends a little bit what we're thinking about. Sometimes people have in mind this somehow innate charisma or this spark of genius or something like that. But often we're talking about things that are a lot more teachable and a lot more prosaic. How do you keep accounting records? How do you know how to do the right marketing? How do you plan for the future? But also we've learned that an entrepreneurial personality, how to be proactive, how to be looking for new opportunities are also things that can be taught. So I think we're increasingly seeing that there are many types of entrepreneurial skills that can be taught after all, we'd have no business schools in the world if we didn't think that there was a way of teaching some of these skills.
David, this review does a wonderful job of summarizing the research that we have. In the research that's been done, what sort of training program, what size of training program, what type of training program is being evaluated?
So we look at a range of different types of programs in this report. The sort of earliest literature in developing countries started with this most prevalent type of firm, which are these self-employed microenterprise owners. Often microfinance organizations or governments would be working to try and raise the incomes of poor people. And so they would have group-based classroom training, groups of maybe 15 to 40 firms for 3 to 12 days in duration, where you would focus on teaching them basic business skills like how to keep records, how to budget, how to manage your inventory, how to do marketing. And so a lot of the studies in the literature are looking at those types of programs. There's then been sort of a second phase that's saying, you know, maybe for these same types of entrepreneurs, we shouldn't be trying to teach them all these different things, but maybe we can make it simpler through some heuristics or behavioral approaches. Maybe we can talk about some of those other skills that we mentioned that are more psychological skills. How do you get this mindset of doing something different? How do you overcome barriers that may face women in small firms? What types of additional efforts do you need for youth who are trying to start up small businesses? So we also look at those types of programs. But then we have a range of different programs that are dealing with bigger firms and entrepreneurs who have multiple workers. And so this can involve teaching lean manufacturing processes, such as the Japanese Kaizen method, which there's a range of programs that try and do this in industrial clusters, to working with firms with 50 workers, 100 workers, where you're doing management consulting and really trying to help do much more intensive types of programs, hundreds of hours, much more expensive, but you're focusing on optimal production processes, removing bottlenecks, more specialized knowledge of how to enter into export markets. And then we have programs that are looking with these new high-tech startups, incubators and accelerators. And, you know, how do you make yourself attractive to venture capitalists? How do you really get on that startup curve and grow rapidly? And so we have kind of a whole range of different types of programs, and some of them have got more evidence than others, but we're trying to summarize what we know about each of these.
It sounds like there is a lot of different types of training that goes on, and many of these programs are quite small in scale and happen quite quickly. Does that make it difficult to interpret the results of them or to think about the external validity of those results?
So the small scale is a challenge for a couple of reasons. And so one is that a lot of the early studies worked with a couple of 100 microenterprises. They would run these programs and they would get these results. And then sometimes they would find that there was no significant impact on the outcomes that they looked at, like profits or sales. And so there was a bit of pessimism. There was a sort of view that training just doesn't work. Mm. But when you looked at these studies, often you found that there was very wide confidence intervals. There's a lot of uncertainty about exactly what the estimates of these programs were, because as you say, they were quite small and you just didn't have a big sample size to see what the impacts were. And so that's one of the advantages of this type of review, is by putting together evidence from many studies, we get a clearer picture of whether these programs are working or not. What we have seen when we put a lot of these studies together is that, yes, there is actually an overall positive effect. And it's an effect that might not have been able to be detected by some of those earlier studies because they just had too small a sample size. And so by putting everything together, we can learn some of the common patterns. We can overcome some of that external validity issues because we see similar things happening in a whole range of countries from these programs. But no one study by itself may have been able to teach us that. The second point you mentioned about external validity and small scale is that, you know, we might learn from some of these programs that this type of program works when done with lots of oversight by an NGO or some researchers with 100 firms. But then if a policymaker is asking, how did we do this for 1,000 or 100,000 firms?
Well, yes.
You know, there's a different scaling question there. So there's sort of two parts of that that we try and think about.
Reading the Vox Devlet, you really are aware of the richness and the variety of the different programs. I'd just like to touch on some of them. First of all, we've mentioned these micro enterprises a few times. Many people are in business because they're just trying to make enough money to get through to the end of the week and feed their families. if we are training these entrepreneurs, what sort of outcomes should we be targeting for them?
Yes, and I think it's very important to be realistic about what you can expect from programs of these types of firms. And so one thing is exactly as you mentioned, survival. We know that the death rate in small firms is very high. I have some work that sort of shows about half of small firms die in 6 to 7 years. If you can help through business training people to survive shocks, to be more resilient, to be able to keep alive when they do face these threats to their livelihood, that's a success in of itself. And so survival is one outcome that certainly we care about. The second thing is just earning more income for your family. Are you able to go from earning $1 a day to $1.10 a day? That makes a big difference, even if it's not transformational in terms of economic growth or getting you to hire workers. And so I think one of the big downsides is when governments think these programs are going to result in these micro enterprises generating lots of additional jobs or having transformational impacts on incomes, when success may be, as you say, just helping people survive and earn a bit more for their families and just be a little bit more confident in these jobs that they have.
If you are providing these programs, what's the best way to do it? Is it sort of classrooms? Is it working informally in groups? Is it one-to-one?
We see positive but relatively modest impacts on average of these standard classroom-based programs. Mm-hmm. If you put people in a classroom for 5 days, 7 days, you tend to get maybe a 5% increase in sales, a 10% increase in profits. That's not trivial for someone who's close to the means of subsistence. So this basic training is useful. It's not transformational. For the lowest educated, most subsistence types of firms, even that classroom training might be more complicated than you want, and having some basic heuristics or rules of thumb seems to deliver similar results or slightly more promising results. So just teaching you to separate your household and your business money and some basic rules of thumb for how to manage your business might be the key thing there. Then we've got some examples of programs that have done markedly better. We have a psychology-based program that we look at in Togo where you're teaching people what's called personal initiative, how to be proactive, have this mindset of looking for new opportunities, having plan Bs, learning from failure, where that had 3 times the impact of the standard training program. Profits increased by 30% over a couple of years. We have a program in South Africa that someone looked at that was really focusing on teaching marketing and how to boost demand for the firms, that had big impacts. But we need more replication of some of those types of efforts to say they're always better. Mm. And so you ask, so what doesn't make a difference or what's not as effective? Very light touch approaches. People have been trying to push out text messages with business tips or things like that. That doesn't seem to help very much. And then the second thing that I guess is perhaps more of a surprise is that on average, we see that when you put people in this classroom training and then you add on top of that a one-on-one mentor, this mentoring hasn't really made much of a difference and tends to be pretty expensive to do.
Right.
That, for these very small firms, is something that I don't think makes sense in the way that it's been done, at least.
Now, another aspect of this, especially if for someone's living close to subsistence, they really need to be able to deliver results all the time, consistently. And if we're going to make a difference, it has to last. What do we know about the persistence of these results?
This was something that we didn't know that much about until quite recently. It's very difficult to run these studies and track these small firms, and most of them stopped at 1 or 2 years out. And so you would see, you know, that's still some decent amount of persistence if you can have an impact that lasts 2 years. But we didn't really know much of what happened beyond that. And so one of the things that now, the last few years, we've been starting to see evidence of is whether these impacts persist. And so we have seen that program I mentioned in Togo with personal initiative training. We now have gone back and measured impact 7.5 years after that program. And we see at least the men that took part in that program are having very substantial sustained impacts of that personal initiative training. In Uganda, some researchers have followed youth who went through a startup program for 9 years, and they're still earning 16% higher profits 9 years later. So we have some evidence that some of these programs can have persistent impacts, but we also have some studies where the impacts don't persist. And so, you know, there's work on mentoring small firms in Kenya where while the mentors are working with them, they have good impacts. And then 6 months later, the impacts have disappeared. Or work that I was part of in Mexico, where we trained some entrepreneurs during COVID over Zoom. And in the short run, they start implementing all the business practices, but then they stop doing that after a while. It's still an open question. When is this impact going to persist? But we at least know now that it can persist. And so we just sort of need to figure out what conditions are needed to make that last.
Moving up the scale to larger firms in high-income countries, then these larger firms, they want to grow quicker, become more profitable, improve their management. They tend to hire consultants and they implement some of these advanced management practices. You mentioned those already. This is quite expensive to do, though. Is this a feasible approach in low-income settings?
For medium-sized firms, we think that this can be an approach that can be done. And there is an industry of private sector consultants in many countries, in Nigeria or in India. And, you know, there are lots of these consultants. One of the troubles that firms face is knowing amongst all the consultants out there who is good and who's bad.
Who's a good one, yes.
Yeah, and whether they can deliver for you. And so there have been government programs that have supported the use of consultants. I worked in Colombia with the government there. And there was a consulting agency that the Japanese had helped train in Japanese lean manufacturing methods. The government funded them to work with firms. And we followed those firms and we found that individual consulting was useful, but it was pretty expensive. As you said, it was $30,000 a firm to provide. Man. But then we worked on a cheaper group-based approach where you had consultants work with groups of 4 to 6 firms at a time. And that was only a third of the cost, $10,000 a firm. And just as effective, if not more effective. And we've now tracked those firms 8 to 10 years later, and those firms are earning $500,000 more a year. That's a real big bang for its buck. And so I think there's ways that you can leverage group effects. You can make these consulting programs seem effective. But I think consulting is a bit of an experience good. One thing we've seen is once firms get a taste for it, they go back and spend some of their own money on it. But it's very hard to know whether it's useful before you've tried it out in the first place.
Now, in Europe, North America in particular, when we think about entrepreneurs, very often we think about startup entrepreneurs and in incubators, getting the knowledge, getting the experience they need. They want to be high growth. They want to attract funding and investment. Is there an equivalent in low-income countries for this model?
There's been a lot of buzz, and there are many of these incubators and accelerators out there in different countries. One of the challenges for trying to know what they do is that they typically work with pretty small cohorts. You know, they may have 10 firms that they're working with at a time. It's very hard to know what the impact of that is and who to compare those firms up to, because they've been deliberately trying to select the firms that they think have got the best potential. And who do you compare those to? We don't have a lot of evidence from very low income countries. You know, many of these ones in Africa that are getting run are in that situation where there's a very small selected sample of firms and we don't have comparators. But we do have evidence from places like Chile and Colombia, which are now upper middle income or even OECD countries, but as countries that many developing countries look to for examples. Also from places in the Western Balkans, where I've worked with Bosnia and Serbia. These programs have been useful in those settings, at least in getting firms more likely to get financing to survive. These incubators provide skills about how to be ready for investors, how to think about managing those types of firms can be done well in at least middle income settings. We see them out there in low income settings, but we just don't have a lot of evidence on how effective they are.
One of the problems with training is it has to stop at some point, but the problems never stop coming if you're running a business. You did mention earlier that in those very small micro enterprises, mentoring didn't seem to have much of an effect. Is that across the board? Can mentoring substitute for some of these training programs?
One of the things with mentors is often that when programs are set up to provide mentors, those programs are limited in duration as well. Oh, and
right,
so sometimes those mentors come in and help the firm solve specific problems. And so we saw that in the study I'd mentioned previously in Kenya. Mentors came in, they helped the firm solve specific problems. Then they stopped the mentoring engagement and the firm was not really left with any lasting ability to solve new problems as they came along. What we've seen is that mentors seem to work better when they help teach you something that you can't learn by yourself and, you know, is maybe hard for you to find otherwise. And so, for example, still relatively small firms, but firms looking to break into new markets in Uganda, when they're matched with more sophisticated mentors who have had experience doing that, can help you do that. So we think of mentoring that's doing gone beyond the sort of very basic training and helping you learn. Similarly, in the Balkans, with these firms looking to break into export markets, having them provide their experience on how to do that. The second thing on that related to the mentoring is peer mentoring, this learning from one another. And so we've seen from China, from Ghana, that if you can get these firms together and learn from and connect from one another, there can be benefits from that that can be relatively sustained. We saw in this group consulting in Colombia as well, where firms can help each other benchmark against one another. They can share knowledge and experiences. And then in some cases, maybe they can also help set up new business contacts or act as suppliers for one another. So I think there's promise in that type of approach, which may be more lasting than if I assign you a mentor and that mentor's maybe around for a while, but then maybe going to go away again.
Now, it's not your first go round on this Vox Devlet, is it, David? Is it, what was it, the fourth edition?
Yes, this is the fourth edition. And so one of the goals of these lits is to be a living literature review where we each time go back and say, okay, what have we learned in the last year or year and a half or so that we didn't know beforehand? And where do we still have gaps?
That's my question. Yes. What have you learned and where are the gaps?
We have about 18 to 20 new studies that we've incorporated in this version compared to the last version. One of the things we've already touched on is now this increasing evidence on long-term effects that we didn't have beforehand. And so from Togo, Uganda, Colombia, showing these lasting impacts. A second area is this very policy relevant area of how do you work with youth in Africa to help them, you know, start up businesses, and the challenges of looking at impacts of those programs when youth are cycling through multiple jobs. Some of them are still in school, they're doing multiple activities. And so you really need to track them for quite a while. And so we're now starting to see positive impacts from some of those programs. Then we also just mentioned this sort of more of this role of a group-based approach. That's been used in a variety of approaches from the group consulting in Colombia to virtual groups with WhatsApp in Ghana to consortia of women trying to export in Tunisia. And so we're seeing more evidence on how you can lower costs and get benefits of group learning from these group-based approaches. And then the last thing that we talk about in this version, which is an emerging issue, of course, in many aspects of economics, is the role of AI and where we're starting to see or not seeing evidence on that and what we can do. As well as this time around, we try and point out a couple of key research gaps that are still out there. One is that we run all these programs, but it's unclear exactly which firms you should be putting in which programs. There's often, you know, lots of conflicting goals. Governments are trying to achieve many things with the same program. And there can be this tendency to try and do something that ticks off too many goals at once and is not very successful at answering any of those goals. If you want to look at high growth firms, but you're also wanting to help women in rural areas who have no wealth, maybe those two goals are not going to coincide. And then the second thing that we point out as a research gap is how much of this can be really done as standalone. We work and we do business training or we do consulting or things, and how much you really need a bundled intervention where you're working with the whole ecosystem, you're working to provide financing and other support to firms, as well as just the training, or is training enough? You train people to figure out how to get financing, or you have to provide that financing? And then the third thing I mentioned a little bit before was how do you scale these programs once you've found them to be successful? We discuss a little bit about that, but there's still a lot of open gaps about how do you take something that's working and make it work for many more.
Policymakers, when they think about entrepreneurs, they think about job creation always, understandably. From something that you said earlier, it sounds like there might not be that much job creation going on here.
Well, so there's job creation for yourself versus job creation for others. And so if we're looking at micro enterprises, you can get these firms to be better jobs that are more likely to last and to earn more incomes for the people running them. But what we see from looking across a whole range of these studies is a very precise zero in terms of the impact of business training for micro enterprises on hiring workers.
Right.
And so you're not doing that with these small firms. When we look at bigger firms with consulting for a firm with 50 workers and we make that more productive and able to expand their sales, then they start hiring workers. And so we're seeing impacts on jobs from working with those larger firms.
Now, what about the opportunities for women who want to be entrepreneurs and who we know often struggle to find the opportunities and the success that they want?
So we see from a range of these programs that they can be beneficial for women, that programs that have tried and look specifically at overcoming some of the additional constraints that women may face in some markets have been useful there. One of the big issues, though, is the role of demand and of oversaturation, where sometimes you get a lot of women all doing the same activities, competing in a very limited market. And then the main constraint is not that you're able to keep books well or that you're able to manage your inventories well. It's just that there's not enough customers. Unless these programs help you think about ways to differentiate yourself and to broaden that market or to move into new industries, then we see that they can be a little less effective for women in those contexts.
So also policy priority to do more with less. And that involves perhaps the role of technology in all of this, because if it delivers training well, then it could do it very cheaply and it becomes very easy to scale. I heard what you said earlier about sending text messages and that has no effect at all. I can really understand that. But now we have different, more advanced technology, specifically AI, things like chatbots and AI-based training. Do we know very much about that impact yet?
There's two areas. So one is using this technology for delivery of training. And so we saw, particularly during the pandemic, a lot of use of online training, that connectivity is now getting higher and you can do training over Zoom. You can work with groups of entrepreneurs in WhatsApp groups. My sense is that a hybrid approach where you have some face-to-face and some online is probably better than all online, but you can reach more people certainly with employing some of the training over technology. We've seen very low take up and a lot of dropout if you just put something up online and ask people to do it without a lot of support. And so that's where the promise potentially is of AI being more active and being not just this passive training that you have to work through yourself, but you can ask it interactively questions and it can provide you advice and maybe you can customize things. There's been a couple of studies. There's been one in China where there was a lot of people selling things on an online platform and then the platform would give them little prompts of, okay, here's a little task for you to do. And so that had very limited impacts, but it was very easy to do and it was scaled at 2 million enterprises. And so that was an example where you could do small things for lots of people with AI, which is one approach, is you get 1% improvement in profits for lots of people. That's still useful. And the second thing is AI becoming more of a substitute for trainer. At the moment, we have one study from Kenya where they set up a WhatsApp interface with ChatGPT, and then business owners could ask their questions and get their responses customized from that. There was no average impact, but what they found was that better business owners seemed to do well from this, and actually business owners who weren't very profitable and not that well managed to start with seemed to suffer from this because they didn't know how to ask the right questions or they didn't know how to interpret the answers very well. And they tried some things and they didn't work out. And so I think it's an area where there's a lot of excitement, but I think it needs a lot of customization. There's a lot of questions about the training data for these AIs and whether it's really well suited for the types of firms that many people are running in low-income countries. And so I think that's something hopefully that version 5 or version 6 is going to have us a lot more to say about.
Your work is not over here yet. David, clearly, if firms are successful, they grow the economy. But also, what's the potential here if we get training right for entrepreneurs? What's the potential for changing their lives, their life opportunities?
Obviously, the most direct one is if we can make them earn more income and have their businesses survive, that's going to be good for them and their families. But one of the interesting things I think that also came out of recent work is that a lot of these entrepreneurship skills can have benefits in other aspects of life as well. There's a study that looks at what happens if you're a worker in one of these high-tech startups and then your firm fails or you end up leaving that firm. Well, that actually is still a really good training ground and you end up being able to go and be a manager or able to move up and earn more income in other firms because of that experience that you've had trying to manage all these new opportunities in a firm. Similarly, some of these skills of thinking about the future, planning and budgeting, you can imagine spilling over to other aspects of life or being proactive and looking for new opportunities, being useful even if you don't go in entrepreneurship too. And so I think that's also one of the reasons that this can be beneficial, but also one of the exciting areas to think about is where entrepreneurship training might have impacts on people beyond just directly making their businesses more successful.
It is an exciting area to think about. David, thank you very much for talking about it today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks very much.
You will find the VoxDevLit at, you will not be surprised to hear, voxdev.org. This has been a VoxDev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to follow us. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are also at voxdev.org. If you like what you are hearing, please tell someone else about us. Leave us a review as well. VoxDev Talks is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber and our editor is Andrei Zargarian. Thanks to Oliver Hanni and Iman Siddiq at VoxDev.